This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Time magazine once called him America's best theologian. Longtime professor at Duke Divinity School, Stanley Hauerwas, has authored many books, won a number of awards, and even appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show. But none of that prepared him for the day a dear friend called on him to offer him a very different job, to be a godfather. And it would be no ordinary relationship. Instead of birthdays and baptism, Stanley Hauerwas was asked to write a yearly letter to his godson. He compiled those words of wisdom in his new book, The Character of Virtue, Letters to a Godson. Stanley Hauerwas is Gilbert T. Rowe Professor Emeritus of Divinity and Law at Duke University. Stanley, welcome back to the show. It's been too long.
It's been a long time. It's good to be here, Frank.
You've been gathering these letters for 15 years or so. Tell us how this came about, because Sam Wells, the former dean of Duke's chapel, became friends of yours.
Sam wrote his dissertation on me at the University of Durham in England, and that's how we got to know one another. And then we became close friends, and when they asked me to be a godfather of their first child, Lawrence, I said, I'm very happy to do that. I'm honored, as a matter of fact, but I'm just a terrible godfather. I don't know what to do. Take God seriously, you know, what do you say? And Sam said, well, I'll give you an assignment. Every year at the anniversary of his baptism, you're to write him commending a virtue. So I started doing that. I didn't intend it to become a book, but the more I developed those letters over the years, Sam and Joe and myself thought increasingly... thought it should become a book. So that's what it's done. That's what I've done with The Character of Virtue.
What were you thinking when you wrote that first letter? What kind of sense of responsibility did you have? You're talking to a one-year-old now, right, and you're going to write about a virtue. How do you do that?
Well, I knew, of course, he wouldn't understand what's going on. I didn't assume that, as I did any of the letters, that he would want to read them. Joe read them to him each time. But I thought of it as kind of creating shards from an archaeological expedition that later in life he may look at it and say, I wonder what in the world that guy was thinking about when he was doing this. And what do all these theological claims make in relationship to the virtues? So I thought of it as a kind of ruin that I was leaving behind for him.
Now, that was when they were in Durham, England. They later did move to Durham, North Carolina, as I said, to become dean of Duke Chapel, did Sam Wells. How did that change things for you? I mean, I guess it's a little unexpected, and suddenly this godson is not across the pond. There he is.
It meant that I would try to convince him that baseball is the sport he always ought to follow.
That's it. Just take the kid to the circus.
Right. And I would take him to basketball games and that sort of thing. But again, I mean, he was 4, 5, 6, 7 while he was here. And you have to respect his character of being a kid that doesn't need to know this kind of thing, per se. So I was just getting to know him, and I didn't want to impose myself on him, though.
What did you start out with? Talk about how you began this, because, I mean, again, it's sort of how you're going to define virtue, what are virtues to you, and then how you're going to extol these virtues. Both, obviously, you're going to send it to a young child, but as you say, this is going to become an artifact later on. It may add up.
Well, my background is I'm trained in theology and ethics, and that when I first came out into the academic world, the ethics that was thought to be at the center was called situation ethics, and it was sponsored by a man named Joe Fletcher. And the questions were always, what would you do in terms of dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And he justified that with utilitarian calculus, thinking that you do what's the greatest good for the greatest number. And somehow I thought that was a mistake, that the first question is not what to do, but who are you? And where did that come from. That, and there was a tradition coming from Plato and Aristotle through Augustine and Aquinas called the virtue tradition that was about the kind of person you ought to be prior to any decision that you were to make. So I became very much a representative of those kinds of considerations of what, of how we initiate people into the ongoing habits necessary for the virtues to become authentic.
But that initiation, it seems to me, is always going to create a context that that individual will grow up in a certain regime with a certain set of values and principles. So you talked about Fletcher's utilitarian accounting in Hiroshima, and the answer is yes, drop the bomb. If you have another accounting and another set of values and another set of priorities, you're going to have a different answer, which suggests that it's going to be hard to hold a virtue constant.
The virtues are known primarily retrospectively. We may think we're being kind, but we may be in the process of satisfying our own egoism in terms of the kind of way we're being kind. So you probably, Aristotle said, eudaimonia, happiness is a life of virtue that will probably, you will only probably know if it's been authentic when you're dying.
Yeah.
So it's an ongoing testing of making your life vulnerable to challenges that come from being part of a good community. And crucial to that, you don't separate the virtues from the narratives that shape us. So stories are absolutely crucial to know what courage is. I mean, for example, if you take courage, it's oftentimes associated with the training of people in military circumstances that know no fear. But that's not courage. That's just foolhardiness. Courage is to have the right fears rightly. And that comes through wisdom. So you can't separate courage from wisdom.
But again, it gets back to this. How do we hold something constant? What gives Stanley Hauerwas the right to say that that form of courage is folly and a different form of courage is the real thing? Where does that come from? What's the absolute authority here that gives anyone the right to install their virtue as ultimate?
Well, I'm a Christian theologian, and so I have to work within the tradition that Christians have developed over the centuries, and there's plenty of resources there. Now, that means if you don't think there's much to be said for the Christian tradition, we have a whole different kind of argument that
but
has
so
been taken
it is
out.
Within. So all of these virtues then have to be seen and understood in their context
yes.
of what tradition. Well, let's talk about yours, because in the Christian tradition there are three theological virtues, as I recall from my catechism, faith, hope, and love. Hope is an interesting one, has always been an interesting one for me, and you write in very interesting ways about it. I wonder if you can read a section of your letter on hope.
Too often, optimism is confused with hope. Optimism is a general attitude that, interestingly enough, presumes that because I can't do much about my life, I can at least be optimistic. In a vain attempt to make the most of my life, I basically don't like. And I'm afraid our culture is more determined by optimism than by hope. That's why so many people try to protect themselves from the illusions that optimism can breed through cynicism. Cynicism is the form that hopelessness takes among a people who no longer believe they're part of a story that can give them hope. Unlike optimism, hope is the habit that believes that arduous good is possible if we rightly learn patience. So I think cynicism is a virtue that's widespread. Mm. As cynicism is a way of trying to say no one will able no one will take over my life because I know everyone's got clay feet. And as a result, I'm free in a way that other people aren't free that are true believers. And cynicism, however, doesn't give us a life worth living.
So talk about this. This is a fascinating distinction, though, that you make, and I want to talk more about the way it's juxtaposed or opposed to cynicism. This idea that hope and optimism are different animals, that we can hope to win the lottery. That's a thing that we're going to know about. There's going to be an answer to that, and either you did or didn't. And then there's this other kind of hope, which is a kind of knowing a truth that may never be revealed, right? I mean, is that part of what you're saying?
I think it is. The virtues, interestingly enough, you can't acquire virtue by trying to acquire virtue. The virtues ride on the back of practices that are fulfilling in a way that we hadn't anticipated by our learning to take them on as habits. And hope is drawn out of us by our loves. And our loves have to be shaped by the virtues. So there's an interaction between the passions through which our bodies pull us into interrelations with others in a way that gives us lives we hadn't anticipated, making us more than we otherwise would be.
Well, and this making us more, I think, brings us to the virtue of generosity, which is another fascinating virtue if we think about even the word itself, genesis or gender to engender to create. In other words, generosity isn't about giving something away. It's about actually making more of something. Would you read from this letter for us?
Sure. So what I'm proposing is that you think of generosity as the capacity to participate imaginatively in the experience, the life of others. A generous person might be thought to be empathetic. I'm sure that empathy is one of the results that generosity can produce. But generosity is more basic than empathy. An empathetic person isn't necessarily generous, but a generous person may and probably will be empathetic. A generous person has the capacity to give themselves to others without any calculations of what they will get in return.
Stanley Hauerwas reading from his book, The Character of Virtue, Letters to a Godson. So tell us more about these, just in those two, hope, this sense that there is something other and beyond perhaps words and beyond the material in which one can dwell, right? A hope and something that can never be proved. And then generosity, which actually creates, right? It actually generates more than its whatever substance was transferred in the transaction. These are fascinating and to me deep thoughts. And it brings me to Augustine, who said, love God and then do what you want. In other words, what Augustine seemed to be saying here is that the behavior is not the issue. It is the place it comes from. If it comes from a place of love, it is virtuous, however it looked to the observer.
Well, of course, for Augustine, love is a virtue. And it is the telos that we are created to desire. And he therefore thought that all the virtues were forms of love in a way that meant you were a follower of Christ in a way that made it possible for you fundamentally to live a life that's vulnerable, but all the more rewarding for being vulnerable.
Yeah, the vulnerability, and this is the second time you mentioned that. Talk more about that and the way in which that becomes the ground of virtue, the launching pad for any behavior that we would recognize as virtue.
Well, the first virtue, of course, I discuss in his first anniversary of his baptism is kindness. And to be kind in a violent world means your life will be in danger. But you can't want to live any other way once you discover how wonderful it is to be kind. And that is fundamentally a way of suggesting to Laurie that the God we worship as Christians is first and foremost kind. The kindness is to be found in the fact that God became one of our kind. So kindness is to be drawn into a world of inner relations that make you see that you cannot be without the other's being. So that's the I wanted to start, and I used, you know, what does it mean to train kids are cruel?
Yeah. There's a lot of meanness in the world that God created, and so you have to sort of account for that, right?
So kindness, to start with kindness as the first virtue, was a way to say you don't become kind by trying to be kind. You become kind by learning to pet your dog.
Well, and this ground of being, I mean, I do wonder about getting yourself to that place that Augustine seemed to talk about when Jesus is asked. He said, love the Lord your God with your whole heart, soul, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And for him, that was one law. There was not two laws. That thing was all one. If you were identified strictly with creation itself, then you will never not love your neighbor, and everything that comes for you probably will be right.
Right. How you learn to love your neighbor, of course, as yourself, is you learn in Augustine to learn to love yourself the way God loves you.
Stanley Hauerwas, theologian, Gilbert T. Rowe, Professor Emeritus of Divinity and Law at Duke University, and the author of The Character of Virtue, Letters to a Godsend. Stanley, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been great to be here. Thanks, Frank.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.